I want to point out as well, I got some, again, through Twitter, this was sent to me. Thank you very much. The Brazil hydroxychloroquine results. This is empirical treatment with hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin for suspected cases of COVID, followed up by telemedicine. Suspected is really an important word in this case, because here's the deal. Here's what they're doing in this particular study. They're saying, look, people are presenting. We don't have time or even the test kit resources to be able to run it to know for sure, do these people have COVID or not? In the absence of that information, if they're presenting with fever, shortness of breath, things like that, we can say, look, it's probable. So we're going to treat people with hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin. All right. I don't see zinc in this one either, but again, I'd love to see zinc. But now, at least they're doing this, and they're doing it early. And so guess what's going to happen here? Some people in these groups aren't actually going to have COVID, and many of them will. So this is going to be a little bit contaminated by the results are going to be contaminated by that lack of COVID in some of the people. But still, what did they find? Well, very startling results here. So they had 636 symptomatic outpatients. 400, and they said, hey, listen, do you want to be part of this trial? Here's what we're going to do. Here are the risks. 412 of those people signed up for that and said, yeah, give me some of that. 224 refused medications, and they were part of the control group. So what they found was the need for hospitalization was 1.9% in the treatment group and 5.4% in the control group. So 2.8 times greater. That's a really big difference right there. Okay. That one right there. And in particular, check this out. In those who started the treatment before versus after the seventh day of symptoms, the need for hospitalization was 1.17 versus 3.2%. So before and after. So this separates even people who are within HCQ plus AZ groups and separates within that group. So we have two findings here. First, with hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin at any point in time, you know, whether it was within 7 days or after 7 days of symptom onset, we saw this 2.8 times greater number of people who weren't treated ending up in hospitals needing hospitalization. But even within the AZ-HCQ group, we find that those who started treatment before versus after the seventh day of symptoms, the need for hospitalization was half. Okay, roughly half. All right, conclusion. This stuff works. P-value, very highly significant finding here. P-value of 0.001. So that's less than a 1 in 1,000 chance that this was just an accidental finding. So very significant. And this is a really positive finding for hydroxychloroquine. What don't we have here? We don't have a randomized trial. What don't we have here? We don't have zinc in here. But still, this is a pretty good result right here. And glad to see this kind of data coming out. In other news, we got news today of a remdesivir failure. This is the Gilead treatment that there's all this excitement around that seemed to be overshadowing the hydroxychloroquine. Why? I don't know. Maybe because this costs $1,000 a dose versus a buck for the hydroxychloroquine. At any rate, we don't have the data on this yet. So let me, again, giant salt shaker, cube of salt on this one. So maybe when the data comes out and we get to see it, we're going to find a very different result. I'm just telling you what the headlines say. And again, the headlines could be very wrong because they often are, right? We know that. Data on Gilead's remdesivir show no benefit for coronavirus patients. What happened was somehow this is early data that leaked out. I think the story I heard was somehow the data accidentally got put up on a WHO website. Somebody grabbed it, reported about on it. Here it is. But we haven't seen the actual data yet from this study. We don't even know anything about it, but that's an early report right there. So let me go ahead and I should have done this. Let's question this. Let's keep an open mind on this for now. All right.
Welcome back to Palisade Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics, and joining me today is Lawrence Lepard, better known as Larry. He runs a gold fund that was up 97% in 2019. How are you today, Larry?
I'm great, Tom. Thanks for having me on your show.
Absolutely. Do you think there are any strategies left that the Fed can take to have any more effectiveness in averting a further decline?
It's a great question. Yeah, I know. Can they reverse this, or could we be wrong? And I was asked this by a really very high-level, high-powered institutional money manager. I mean, somebody who literally is in, you know, in a position to control billions. And he asked me, you know, what could make your thesis wrong? Tell me, you know, what could, you know, he said, I agree with you, but what could make you wrong? And I honestly only see one thing that could make the thesis wrong. I mean, there are probably more that I don't see, but the one that I see is if every government in the world decided to make gold ownership illegal and confiscate all the gold mines, you know, and you know, there's a motivation for them to do that, and that is that, you know, gold is gold and gold mining, you know, it's an existential threat to their fiat money system. And, you know, my belief is that, you know, once gold breaks through 1900, which will happen soon, and then through 2000 and 3000 and 4000, Gresham's law will kick in and everyone in the bond market will say, you know, hey, Fed, sold to you. And, you know, the curve will get parabolic and it'll just be a matter of time before the dollar's worthless. You know, but and so if they're smart, they understand that. And then if they're evil, which they are, they go to the next step, which is, all right, we got to prevent that from happening. And, you know, Summers and you know, Borofsky, you know, with Gibson's paradox paper years ago, set Rubin on the path to suppress gold. And that's how we got to where we are today. So here's the question, you know, and he asked me to handicap the odds if that happens. And I said, you know, maybe it's 20%. One, getting a lot of governments around the world to agree is going to be hard. And I'm not sure Russia would go in that direction since they have a lot of gold and they're fiscally pretty sound. You know, I'm not sure China would go there either. You know, they've encouraged their citizens to own gold and they own a lot of gold. I think the narrative of what's going on here is that, you know, the elites and people in large organizations and powers of places of power are being shown to be frauds and they're losing their grip on that power and they don't like it. But, you know, there's 7 billion of us and they're, you know, a much smaller number of them. And, you know, I kind of compare them to the French aristocracy. I mean, there were, you know, 300,000 French aristocrats in 1788 and 3 years later, there were 15,000 and the guillotine, you know, provided the difference. You know, I don't think we're going there. Obviously that's wrong. And that's not what I hope for. But my point is that a lot of people, there are a lot of people who, if told to hand in their gold, wouldn't. And a lot of people in the United States who are heavily armed. And, you know, I think the elites, you know, are probably aware that there's only so far they can go. And so, you know, to me, the more intelligent way for them to address this, once they realize it's getting out of control, is to halt the market, stop, and do a one-time devaluation of the dollar. Where, you know, they, you know, 10 old dollars equals one new dollar and the new dollar is fully backed by gold. And they go forward on a new, you know, reduced basis. In a sense, it's a debt jubilee or a restructuring. You know, will they be intelligent enough to do that before we get to hyperinflation? I don't know. I kind of doubt it. I actually think we'll get to the stage where the dollar is completely worthless and there will be a complete political upheaval. And then, you know, some people will run for office that are actually quite honest, and it'll be obvious that they're honest because of the things they're saying about sound money and other stuff, and they'll be voted in overwhelmingly, and then they will investigate the people who did this to us, and, you know, Ben Bernanke will be in the history books right there with John Law, and I mean, that's what I'm living for. You know, I'm 62 and I hope I live to see it. I think I will, because, you know, this evil system is going to collapse on itself. And as you and I discussed in the prelude to this call, all the rules are going to change. And I, you know, I like the cards we hold, but could they mess with it? Sure, they could. And, you know, they may try and jam us into a crypto of some kind, but, you know, or they may, you know, Rickard says we're going to go to some super SDR as the reserve currency. And I say, no, guys, you just don't get it. You know, this is going to be bad enough that nobody is ever going to trust governments, big centralized government again, ever. Or to the degree they do, it's only after it's going to be severely and significantly reformed. And, you know, it's going to be, unfortunately, a messy process. The positive of it all, and, you know, I've got kids, is that I think we will get through it. And I think once we reset it, you know, it's going to be so much better. The world is going to be such a better place, you know, with sound money and with all the corruption, you know, or a lot of the corruption weeded out of it, you know, the military-industrial complex. You know, be a shadow of its former self. The notion of, you know, large warfare would, you know, disappear, etc. So that's a windy answer to your question, but it's it is the one thing I get concerned about. I mean, if they try and grab all the gold and grab all the mines, you know, what are we going to reset against? I mean, in a sense, that's an argument for Bitcoin, right? You know, they could try and shut that down too. But once again, look at the numbers, look at the math. There's 7 billion of us, and you know, you can only kiss on our legs so long and say it's raining. We'll figure it out is my belief.
Absolutely. Hopefully that re-education is coming. As we look at, let's say, how to hide in that storm, one of your main themes is to place an asymmetrical bet. We have $400 trillion of paper investments, and maybe go through and explain to us a little bit about where that money can go and how small the markets are for.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, there's 190,000 tons of gold in the world, from the beginning of time. And, you know, some of it's in, you know, mosques and churches, and some of it's around women's necks in India, and some of it's in central bank vaults, and they're not going to be selling it. If you actually look at the value of the tradable gold of, you know, bullions and coins today, last time I did the math, it was about $2.7 trillion. And there's about $1 trillion plus or minus, and these are rough numbers, of gold mining equities out there. So let's call it $3.7 trillion on, you know, $400 trillion of all stocks, bonds, and cash in the world. So it's less than 1%. It's just a sliver less than 1% of assets out there. And I think what will happen is people will realize these people who are the monetary stewards are just going to print money forever. We know what that means. That's Zimbabwe, Venezuela, Weimar. And, you know, gosh, I own these bonds. You know what? I bet they're not going to hold their real value. Maybe I need to sell some of those bonds and buy some of that gold. So you're going to have some fraction of the $400 trillion chasing the 2.7 or the 1. So, you know, what happens if 10% of the people holding the financial assets say, we need to hold this other stuff? You know, that's $40 trillion tracing something today that's on a market that has a market value of, you know, let's call it 4. That's 10x, you know, on today's gold price. I mean, that's $16,000 gold, because you can't, you know, it's not like we can increase the supply of gold that much. I mean, it grows at 2,900 tons a year, plus or minus. And so that's, you know, 1.7%. So, you know, that's what I think people are failing to understand, is that that's a really asymmetric bet. I mean, gold's not going to zero. It took time and money to get it out of the ground, and I doubt that anybody is ever going to say gold is worthless completely. Gold obviously can go up and down. I mean, it went from 1900 to 1000. So that was if you bought it at 1900, that was a 50% loss on your money. And who knows, it could happen again. But the point is that it could also go the other direction, and it could go, you know, it could double, triple, quadruple, quintuple. And, you know, that's an asymmetric bet, right? Then there's the probability. What's the probability of the one versus the probability of the other? Well, you know, maybe a few years ago, what I'm describing didn't look very likely because, you know, the economy is doing well and, you know, hey, gold, who needs gold, right? I'll buy Apple. But, you know, that's changed, right? I mean, you've now just had, you know, I mean, to me, what just happened looks kind of like the GFC, global financial crisis in 08. And, you know, all the debt is now in the process of being destroyed. And, you know, the government, in order to try and keep the system working, has to support that debt. And they only have one way to support it, and that's to print fiat and get it into the system any way they can. And, you know, as the debt's destroyed and people sell the debt, the government says, fine, I'll buy the debt to hold its value up, even though it's a bursting bubble. But in the process of buying the debt, they're printing money. And that printing of money, you know, there's only so many goods and services in the world, and there's so much money and financial assets in the world. And the money and financial assets represent a claim on the goods and services. And, of course, the money and financial assets got into a huge bubble. And so, you know, the money is bad, and therefore, you know, but the goods and services are real. And so, you know, as that bubble collapses, it becomes apparent the money is bad, and people will move to a money that's good, which is gold, you know, has been good for 5,000 years, gold and silver. So it's an enormous asymmetric bet. And in my opinion, it could end up being one of the largest wealth transfers in the history of mankind. I mean, I think it's going to absolutely stun people what's going to happen, in the next 5 to 10 years. I think it's going to be truly stunning. And some of us have been saying this and saw it coming, and we've been called crackpots, but you know, when it happens, I suspect people will view it somewhat differently.
Is 16,000 possible, and what are the next important numbers on the way up to that?
Right. Well, just as a market analyst, I mean, you know how things go. I mean, the first big important number is 1900, because that was the high in 2011, I mean, plus or minus, I don't have the exact figure, but so, you know, when we take out 1900, let's say, you know, hey, gold is at an all-time high, you know, historically forever. And by the way, you know, as you're probably aware, and I'm sure everyone listening is aware, it's already at an all-time high, almost every currency. I'm not sure where it is versus the Chinese yuan, but I know in all other major currencies, it's already at an all-time high. So it's just the dollar, which, you know, has been the reserve currency that it's not at. You know, so that'll be a big one, right? We're, you know, all-time high in price of gold. And that'll wake people up. It'll be at the top, you know, that'll be on newspapers. Then the round numbers start to become important. 2,000. Oh, wow, that's, you know, $2,000 gold. I mean, it was, you know, at one point it was 3,000, now it's 2. You know, and then, okay, 3,000. Oh, geez. I mean, it's not coming back down. What's going on here? You know, 4,000, 5,000. And I mean, 16 could be just jacks for openers. I mean, it depends on a lot of things. It depends on how much money gets printed. And I've seen calculations all over the place. And it depends on, I mean, eventually we're going to go to a gold standard, right? And it depends on how much, you know, you can have a gold standard with 100% coverage of the outstanding monetary base, or you can actually make it work with like 40% coverage, because not everybody's going to demand the gold instantly. So, and, you know, I've seen math that shows gold prices should be 10,000, 20,000, 40,000. You know, you can get to 100,000, you know, almost on today's money outstanding. And by the way, the money outstanding, you know, is growing almost at a parabolic rate. And I think a number that's very important for people to focus on, probably haven't, is if, so the Fed balance sheet before this whole thing started was $3.7 trillion. You know, it's now in 2 weeks, it's gone up to 5.8. If you take the growth rate in the last 2 weeks of the Fed balance sheet and you annualize it, the Fed balance sheet is growing, and it may not continue at this rate, but it might. It's growing at a $30 trillion annualized rate. So the Fed balance sheet represents the money in the system, or money in credit in the system. It's given to banks and then loaned out through fractional reserve banking. And so, you know, basically, if we were to continue at this rate in the next year, you know, we would be increasing the money / credit in the system by a factor of 10x. Now, how do you increase the money? You know, you only got so many goods and services. We haven't increased the amount of food or oil or cars or anything else in the world by 10x, but we've increased the amount of money by 10x, and the money eventually will chase the goods. There's a lag. But, you know, so how do you not get price inflation in that environment? And then, you know, also in that environment, how does the bondholder who says, I'm thinking, you know, I'm going to get paid back at some point in the future, not start to worry about, yeah, they'll give me the money back. My $1,000 bond will be worth $1,000. But what's that going to buy? You know, in real terms, if there's inflation and everything else, that's not going to buy nearly as much. I need to sell that bond. And so they're going to say, all right, I'm going to sell it. And, you know, and in turn, what that would normally do is it would drive interest rates up, because, you know, you sell a bond, it's less demand for bonds, and therefore interest rates go up. But in this case, the Fed has already signaled that they're going to do YCC, which is yield curve control. They know that the world can't live, a highly leveraged world can't live with higher interest rates. And so what they're going to say is, all right, you know, we're about to, and this is financial repression. It's what they did after World War II, because we ran huge deficits in World War II. And this is what the modern monetary theory crowd says. You know, you go back and you look and say, well, we got through World War II without hyperinflation. True, but the dollar was backed by gold then. So it was a slightly different world. And, you know, they're gonna say we can't let interest rates go up, so we got to buy those bonds when they come up for sale. And, you know, they've already talked about it. I mean, Lyle Brainard signaled it in May, and then Powell reiterated it this fall that, you know, they're going to do yield curve control. And so, you know, the bondholders are going to say, we're selling this bond, interest rates go up. The Fed's going to say, we can't have interest rates go up. We're going to buy that bond. How are they going to buy that bond? They're going to print money to buy that bond. That's going to make their balance sheet get bigger. And so what I see happening is, this is a doom loop, right? You know, the more money they print, the more inflation goes up. The more inflation goes up, the more bondholders say, sold to you, Fed, which means they got to print more money. So, I mean, can you see how the problem, the solution to the problem makes the problem, their perceived solution of the problem, which is print money, makes the problem worse, which is, you know, there's a lot of money chasing fewer goods, there's more inflation. And that's how it happens. That's how it happened in Weimar. Now, somebody said, well, isn't there a way they can stop printing money and solve the whole problem? Yeah. And this, by the way, happened at a small scale in the 70s, right? so, you know, Paul Volcker came in and put interest rates, and we had runaway inflation in the 70s, or high inflation, not hyperinflation, but very high inflation, you know, in the teens. And it was getting away from everybody. The dollar was sliding. And, you know, gold had gone from a $35 fixed price, which was suppressed, to an $800 price in the late 70s. And there were people thinking the dollar was going to fail. And Paul Volcker came in and said, no, we're going to stop that. And he put interest rates at 20%. And because the world wasn't so leveraged at the time, the world was able to handle that. I mean, it almost put my father out of business. He had a business that had a lot of debt and carried a lot of inventory. And, you know, 20% interest rates was brutal. But he made it, and most businesses made it. And then interest rates came down and things got more normal, and inflation subsided. But the way to handle inflation is to push real rates up extremely high. But, you know, can you imagine, even if we took interest rates to 5 or 10% today, most of the country would go bankrupt. I mean, hell, the Fed wasn't even able to normalize interest rates back up to 3.5%. I mean, I think they only got as high as 2.5% in this last cycle. So the point I'm trying to make is that the Fed is really trapped. And if you read the history of Weimar, which I've done, I've read every book I can on Weimar, it was the exact same thing. I mean, you know, Rudolf von Hammerstein was the central banker there. He was forced to, you know, it was kind of like, I've either got to keep printing money now and hope that we find a solution, or I've got to stop printing and the whole thing's going to collapse into a pile of rubble. And, you know, the thing ultimately did collapse into a pile of rubble with the money being worthless. But by printing, he was able to extend it out a few years. And, you know, I feel like we're watching history repeat right here. I mean, it's ironic that happened from 1920 to 23. And the real severe inflation there was a 3-year phenomenon. And isn't it odd that here we are in 2020, exactly 100 years later, and it feels like we just kind of crossed the Rubicon with all this, you know, all the government programs that just got put in place. And that's the other thing I should mention that's really stunning to me. I mean, they went from a deficit of $1.5 trillion kind of as a run rate to they just, you know, and I'm not saying they shouldn't have done this. It's compassionate to help people who are hurting from this COVID thing. But, you know, they went out and they did $2 trillion of spending, just bang, no problem. Then they borrowed another $4 trillion, or they're going to lend another $4 trillion into it, with some of which will be forgiven. So that's $6 trillion. And then Trump is calling for a $2 trillion infrastructure bill. So the U.S. federal deficit is about to go from 1.5 to, you know, I'm spitballing it as kind of 6 or 7, you know. So we've got tax revenue, tax income of, you know, kind of, you know, 2.5, 3, something like that. Well, it's over 3, but it'll go down with this downturn because people aren't working. And so I was spitballing as kind of like 2.5, you know, because of the fall in economic activity and in tax revenue, and then, you know, 7. So we're going to run a $5-7 trillion deficit, and we're going to print the money to do it. And the base money supply pre all of this was $3 trillion. I mean, really, we're going to double. I mean, it's just stunning, Tom. I mean, the whole thing is just stunning to me. And so, you know, it's a very much a case of the game is afoot. And you know, and by the way, a lot of people figured it out, right? You know, take a look. I find it fascinating that, you know, in the last 3 weeks, and I talk to and deal with a lot of coin shops. I mean, you know, I've got an email from one of them that said the demand for their product went up 10x in under a week. And, you know, and you can't find in traditional coin dealers who used to sell coins at premiums that range between 3% and 12%, kind of averaged in the 5-7% range. You can't find anybody who has any with this at that kind of a premium. I mean, the premiums are much, much higher. I've seen as high as
we're up over 20% right now. Last time I looked.
Right, for gold, and then the silver is more if you can get it. And of course, eBay is, you know, that's crazy pricing, but I've seen eBay pricing the premiums 100%. So yeah, people figured it out, right? The money, what's going on here, the big picture view of this just is the money's going bad, folks. And, you know, and so given that the money's going bad, yeah, you use it for transactions, you have to. You can't pay in gold, but, you know, it's inconvenient to pay for things in gold, although there's services that are addressing that. But you know, the money's going bad. So your savings, you know, you've got to get them into gold or silver or gold and silver mining companies, although they have a lot of risk. So, it's very obvious to me. And I think what will happen here is it will become obvious to the whole population over some period of time. And those of us who've been in the investment world for a long period of time know that if you're able to find something that, you know, a lot of people are going to gravitate toward, you know, you can make a lot of money. I mean, I was, before I got into this area in 08, I was a venture capitalist, and somebody gave me a card with an internet address in 93 and explained what it did. And I thought, good Lord, this is really powerful if they get it working right. And so I started making a bunch of investments in that area, and you know, it worked incredibly right. I mean, it was clunky in the beginning, but eventually they got a browser and they got graphics, and they, you know, the broadband came along. You didn't have to do dial up and so on and so forth. And, you know, we were in front of an enormous trend, and therefore made a lot more money than we deserved to make. But, you know, I'll take it. Thank you very much. And I kind of feel like that's what's going on here. I mean, that was an asymmetric bet, and where there was a good idea that a bunch of people were going to gravitate toward. And I think this is a similar kind of thing. It's an asymmetric bet that, you know, sound money is important. The world is structured in a way that it's going to become really important. Some of us understand that and know it. More people are knowing it, learning it every day. And, you know, to me, the way you can tell where we are on this roadmap is just look at the gold price. You know, just chart the gold price and look at it. And you know, there's another interesting thing to talk about. There's a lot of interesting stuff happening there, right? I mean, the spread between the futures and spot, you know, is huge. The premiums last night were $70. You know, you never used to see that in the past. And what that tells you is somebody's willing to pay. The spot price is a bullshit price. It's, you know, it's the COMEX fraudulent price, you know, based on what, you know, people, they say they're trading gold at, but what they're really doing is they're trading paper at that level. You know, people who know what gold is, you know, they're buying the futures price, and the futures price is already over $1,700.
Even the spot, so, even the spot versus futures versus physical is a major disparity.
Exactly. And what that tells you, there's stress in the system. Another example of that is, you know, you saw it, and I mean, this is a classic. You know, they're denying that there's any problem, right? But the COMEX was having trouble sourcing 100-ounce bars. And so the LBMA in London said, oh, yeah, no, don't worry. We're creating a new contract that's equal to four COMEX bars, and we'll ship you some of our 400-ounce bars. But there's nothing to see here, folks. Everything's good. We got plenty of gold. You know, there's a huge stockpile in our vault, even though a lot of it's already spoken for. And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, they denied it three times. I mean, you know, how do you know when a government's lying, when they deny it three times? And, you know, there are people, there are bloggers on Twitter and others who've pointed this out. One of the best, by the way, I highly recommend everyone follow Alistair McLeod from Gold Money. The guy's a genius and he really gets it. And, you know, he's pointing out that he's been blogging and explaining this problem in supply. And he's been getting all these emails from the LBMA and COMEX kind of trying to calm him down. Like, no, we got plenty. It's all good. You know, and it's like they're protesting too much, right? I mean, they got a serious problem. And that brings up a whole different issue, which is the issue of paper gold. I mean, you know, Jeff Christian of LBM, or of, you know, Aaron and Goldman Sachs back in the day testified in front of the CFTC that there are 100 paper claims for every real ounce of gold in the world. If that's the case, what's going on here is they're running the largest game of musical chairs ever played, right? And so people who own GLD or they own a paper claim on gold are at great risk of coming and saying, please give me that gold, and it won't be there. You know, and the person who issued them the claim, the counterparty is going to fail. The counterparty is going to be Lehman Brothers. They're not going to have the gold to deliver. And, you know, at some point, what could happen here, what I anticipate happening here is actually, and this is a mistake that all financial models make, they assume continuous pricing and continuous price models. It's entirely possible here that what happens is we wake up one day and the price of gold is $5,000 an ounce. And there's none for sale at that price. I mean, that's how it's going to end.
And it's just going to keep spiking from there, correct?
Yeah, right. And there's literally going to be no dollar price at which you can buy gold. And the reason that's the point at which the dollar has failed, because no one wants one. And everyone who has one will be doing everything they can to spend it as quickly as they can to get something real. And they'll be paying, you know, $10 an egg or $1,000 to fill up their car or whatever it is, because at least that's gasoline, not paper. And that's how it happened. And that's how it happened in Weimar. The difference was just that they actually had wheelbarrows and they were, you know, they had these notes and they were wheeling the money around. And the thing that's different about Weimar than today is the hive is so connected and you can do all this with a mouse click. We're not going to need, you know, we don't need wheelbarrows. All we need is a mouse. You know, you move your money, you know, take it out of here, put it over there, you know, buy me some gold.
So as we were speaking of asymmetrical bets, Lawrence, do you think silver, as we saw the recent gold to silver ratio was at an all-time high, do you think that silver has even more explosive upside?
I do. I mean, Most of your listeners probably already know this, but I mean, silver is gold on steroids. It's much more volatile. There's not as big a stockpile. It gets absorbed and used in industrial and solar applications, and medical applications. It's the junior brother to gold. It's easier for the common man to own because it's gold's more expensive, and there aren't many ways to buy. Some people have the money to buy big amounts of gold. It's also a little more tied to inflation because of the industrial use piece of it, but it is fundamentally a precious metal, and it's been money for a long time, and it's rare and it's hard to mine. And it's going to do extremely well, but with much bigger amplitude swings. I was reviewing it with somebody on the phone yesterday. I mean, in the 2008 to 2011 run up, I think gold at the bottom of 2008 was about 7,000. I think it went to 1,900. So it did kind of a 2.5 bagger. And that period of time, I think silver went from kind of 910 to 50. So it was a 5 bagger or more. I may have those numbers off a little bit, but the point is that it's high beta gold. And I own a lot of silver too, and I own a lot of silver miners, and I believe very much in silver. As a metal, storing it personally, I mean, to get a lot of value into silver, and I've done that. I bought a lot of silver, and I bottomed out the shocks in my pickup truck because it was so damn heavy for the amount of money it was there, and I could have put the same amount of value in a couple of briefcases, in gold, and that's the problem. I mean, the silver's heavy relative to its value, and it's harder to store and so forth. But it actually makes a great metal for everyday transactions. I mean, it's hard to make change for a 1 ounce gold coin. It's pretty easy to make change in junk silver quarters or even a silver ounce, which, today is, the spot price is, $14, but the real market price is $22. I mean, $22 is a really nice amount. I mean, it'll be much higher in the future, but that's a tank of gas, or that's a bunch of steak, or that's dinner for a couple people, whatever it might be. I don't know if we'll ever be, exchanging coins. There's probably, in this transition, there'll probably be a very brief period where, the money will be kind of completely broken. And I'm not sure if we'll kind of go back to a barter, but, the government will have to very quickly come up with an alternative currency solution. They're not going to have to back it with something, or else people won't accept it.
So to take a riskier view of, let's say, investing, as we go through this transition, I know you like small producers. And if you could give us kind of your thesis on.
Yeah, well let me take you through kind of all from top to bottom, right? So I think everybody should start off, they should own some gold. You shouldn't even buy some miners until you own some gold. Because the system could totally blow up. The stock exchanges could blow up. I'm not saying and believing any of that will happen. I'm just saying the gold is the core of your savings. You should own it. You should own it in your own possession, okay? Then you should own some silver. That's next. The reason you should own that is that's good for transactions. The same story in your possession. You could use it for transactions in a world with no money, no working, functioning money, which would only be a brief period of time. Then, okay, so those are, to me, that's, in the bonds cash or in the bonds stocks portfolio that every investor, investment advisor says, well, you should be, your age is, put that amount in bonds, but 40% in stocks. I'm 62. To me, I should have 60% of my money in gold and silver, and then I should have 40% in stocks, because stocks are risky and stocks are, gold is the goose that lays no eggs, right? It just sits there. That's Buffett's line. It doesn't grow except to the extent it grows vis-a-vis fiat. Stocks, on the other hand, gold stocks, that's a goose that actually lays eggs. They're pulling gold out of the ground and creating positive cash flow if they're doing it right. Within the gold stock universe, let's go from top to bottom. The safest, with the least downside in this last downturn, the safest place, the place to put my mother's money, is in the streamers. It's a better business model. They're very diversified. They let other people take a lot more of the operating risk. They're taking their money kind of off the top in the form of a royalty or an NSR or a stream bought at a fixed price or slightly increasing price over time. And so, the streamers, Franco-Nevada, Wheaton, Sandstorm's a favorite of mine, and others, that's job one, or safety job one. Then you just start to go down the market. You've got the majors, the well-run majors like Barrick and others. I like Kinross and Eldorado. Agnico's an extremely well-run company. It's not cheap. You know, and there are a number of other majors in various stages of being good or bad. The advantage with them is that they generally have a lot of properties and their management's fairly professional, and they're, you know, there's just less volatility and risk, although there's volatility and risk there. The problem with the majors from my point of view and why I don't hold a lot of them is that they're very hard to grow. I mean, when you're producing 5 million ounces, it's hard to grow your production by 20%, you know, or 30%. And, you know, if you want, when you're buying stocks, it's being hard to replace the ounces you mine. And so if you're buying stock, you know, in a gold mining company, you know, you want increasing production and increasing cash flows for the obvious reasons. So, you know, where I participate much more heavily is what I would call the mid cycle or mid-size emerging producers who aren't producing 5 million ounces. They're producing between, you know, in some cases 50 or 100, but more likely I've got a lot of companies that are producing between 200 and 600,000 ounces per year. And they tend to, you know, be growing that over time steadily. They tend to have a good cost profile, and they tend to, you know, be profitable. And they, well, in fact, in all cases, they're profitable or won't invest. And they, you know, in today's world, actually, they're ironically selling at pretty low multiples to cash flow. I mean, I've got several that sell at 2x cash flow. I've got a lot that sell at 3, 4, 5x cash flow, which is really cheap. And when you're in one of the majors, as an example, last time I did the numbers for Barrick, they probably got better with higher prices, but I think Barrick was 12x cash flow. So, you know, if I can buy a gold miner at 3x cash flow when the majors are selling at 12x, you know, I've got a shot at multiple expansion, right? So the producers, you know, that's 70% of what I'm doing. The next two categories are the developers, which are people who found gold, have it in the ground, but have not built the mine to bring it out yet. And there's a lot of risk in that process. I mean, a million things can go wrong. It's like Murphy's Law on steroids. So, but occasionally you can buy them cheap enough and the team is good enough and the deposit's good enough that you can think, well, if they're able to pull this off, this is really going to be worth, you know, 10x what I'm paying for it. And therefore it justifies taking the risk that they won't be able to pull it off. So it's asymmetry with more risk. And the third category of the drill stories.
Are there some names you'd like to share with us in the developer category?
Yeah. You know, I've shared a lot in the past. And I'm as a result of, advice from a lot of people, I'm cutting back a little bit on my sharing. I will say that for what it's worth, I mean, and so obviously I'm in favor of these two companies. I am on the board of Amarillo Gold and I am on the board of Rise Gold. They both have substantial risks. So I'm not, humping those stocks. I've made investments in them. I believe in the combination of risks and rewards there that they're attractive. Actually, they're a little more attractive, particularly Amarillo is a little more attractive now than when I got in because this downturn has hit it. But, you know, this is a risky space to be involved in, and it's going to take time and a higher gold price for these to both work out. But, you know, you could get multiples of your money in these if they work, particularly in Rise, you know, and you're not going to get, you know, I mean, look, in a higher gold price environment, you know, Barrick will double or triple. In a higher gold price environment, if these opportunities work, you know, I can't see how they're not at least 10x. So, you know, invest accordingly. They could also be minus 1x. And, you know, and that's happened before and I've been wrong before. So, you know, so use caution. I mean, I think, you know, somebody who's in this area who wants to speculate and wants to put 1% of their capital in something like this, knowing that if it works, it could really be a winner. And that might make some sense. It depends on who you are. You know, but the final story, the drill stories, and these are people, you know, geologists who have knowledge of rocks and structures and, you know, can basically make a strong argument that if we put some drill holes in an area, we'll find a deposit. And if they do, you know, it can be a 10 to 100 bagger. And if they don't, you lose all your money. And that's about 10% of my portfolio. And, you know, I've got some names and stories I like there. But again, I'm going to hold back. Part of the problem with recommending names is that you recommend a name and, you know, a lot of my names work great, but then occasionally you really blow it. Like I went on Twitter and I recommended a name and a goddamn company just, you know, cocked it up so badly. I thought there was no way they could, but they did. And, you know, I feel pretty bad that I recommended that name and I lost money on it too. And the one I'm talking about is TMAC, you know, so, you know, it's these all have risk and we all know that. And people need to be aware of the risk they're taking when they're investing in these stocks. It's, you know, you can make money in them for sure, but it's not easy. And, You know, anybody who tells you it is isn't really thinking through or doesn't really fully understand the space.
Larry, I really appreciate your time, as I know you're busy writing your March quarterly letter. Can you tell everybody where to find you?
Yeah, sure. So there are two ways to find me. I'm on Twitter, so it's at Lawrence Lepard, just one word, Lawrence Lepard, LEWRENCELEPARD. And then my email, if anyone sends me an email, I'll add them to the mailing list and send my most recent reports, and they'll get future reports. These are all free. L Lepard, so two L's, EPARD, at EMA, the letters Edward Mark Alpha, the number two, not spelled out, but the number two dot com. That's my email. So, and I, you know, I try to help people as much as can. I do get more emails and more DMs on Twitter than I'm able to respond to. And I apologize for that. I just, job one is for my investors trying to pick the right names. And, when I have time, I respond, but I just don't always have time. So if I don't respond to you, please don't, please don't be insulted or take it personally. I'd help everybody if I could and if I had the time.
Excellent. Well, your Twitter feed is very valuable and you're very active there. It's one of my favorites. Thanks for your time today, Larry.
Oh, thanks, Tom. It was an honor to be with you, and I hope we're able to talk to you in the future.
Absolutely. We'll be glad to have you back.
Think you understand the junior mining sector and you think that the participants in the mining sector, junior mining sector, are good people and kind people, hit the bid.
How violent that term could be, it actually could be quite violent. It could be a rip your face off uranium rally.
And the world is always going to need raw material. It's going to need copper and gold and nickel and so forth.
Totally destabilized. Hey, troll, did you hear what's going on in Yemen?